the end of this to discuss some of these things. So that means everybody pay close attention. We didn't have a chance to do that last night. We were a little crunched on time, but tonight we have some time to do that. So you have some family discussion questions that are at the end of this session, and you will have a chance to sit and talk and discuss some of these things. There also were family discussion questions from last night's lesson, so I would encourage you to, when you go home as families, one of those family worship times or other things, that you would work through those questions. They probably will take you about 10 family worship times because I always give you lots of questions so you never run out of things to do. Tonight, of course, I've given you enough questions that you can't get through all those either, but that's so that you can go home and continue this. Because the reason that we have Parent-Teen Weekend is because I'm convinced, that these things need to be talked about amongst all of you. If I just teach them to the parents, there can be kind of a disconnect sometimes with the teens. If I just teach them to the teens, then the parents don't know what I taught. So the issue is, particularly in this with this idea of holiness, and particularly in relationships, that you would kind of have we would have a central discussion from God's Word where these things are presented, and then you as parents and teens, parents and young people, would in fact go home and discuss these things and work through them. And I have to say, this is, to be able to do a retreat like this, an event like this, is really it is one of the greatest joys of my life. When I was in youth ministry before, I would often do things with youth, and I rarely got the parents to come. Although we tried to do that, they would rarely come. We'd say, you know, we'd have a parent-teen thing, and most of the teens would come, and the parents wouldn't come. It is a precious joy to have you parents here, to have you teens here, to do this together. Because my great frustration in youth work was that I was talking to the teens, and you know what? A lot of the teens were getting it. And they were getting excited about the things of the Lord, and they were trying to change, and yet the parents weren't getting it. And they were struggling in their own families. I was almost creating discord in the very family because the families weren't there. So this is a precious privilege, and it's not done by accident. I love to do these things together. So I'm very thankful that everyone is here. And I hope and pray that this will be a blessing to you, particularly in this area of relationships, because it's a tricky one. But the bottom line is that 90% of our lives are spent in relationship of one type or another. And we're not going to talk about all types of relationships tonight, but we are relational people. God is a relational God, and He has placed us in relationship with others so that we might learn to reflect His glory to them. When I was in high school, I moved the first 3 years of high school, I went to 3 different high schools. And so I didn't really have kind of a group of people that I knew very well. And when I was in 11th grade, I moved from California to Colorado. And I had to reestablish a whole group of friendships. I kind of walked in absolutely cold. I had no idea who they were. All of these people, of course, had been together, you know, like all of their lives from grade school. And I was going to a downtown school in Palmer High School in Colorado Springs. And I didn't know anybody. And I had to kind of readjust because, you know, I'd been in Tucson and Arizona. And I'd had, you know, for about 14 years, I'd had my whole group of friends. Then in the 3 years that I was in California, two and a half years, I developed a whole new group of friends that I really loved and cared for, and now I had to reestablish and develop a whole other group of friends. And I despaired of this. I did not want to do this. I was tired of doing it. And so I kind of determined, well, I'm just going to kind of hide, and I'm not going to do much, and I'm just going to kind of, you know, pretend that I'm just going to be a wallflower and not do anything. Of course, if you know me, that you might realize that's probably a little difficult. The very first class that I went to, I was going to an English class, the very first week of classes, there was a group of people sitting in the back, and they were talking about Christian things. And so that kind of piqued my interest, and so I went to sit with them and found myself in about 10 minutes in this rousing discussion on whether or not the Bible was actually true. This is like my second or third day of class. I've got all of these Christian kids, claiming to be Christian kids, who are having this big debate as to whether or not God's Word is actually true, whether it's actually accurate. These are 11th graders, and this was just brought up. The teacher didn't bring it up. They're just discussing it. And so I instantly found a group, not necessarily of close kindred friends, because most of them didn't believe that God's Word was accurate. But I found a group of people who was interested in talking about those things. And of course, I had some very strong opinions on that. And so we had a long discussion. And in fact, over time, that whole year, pretty soon the teacher would say, okay, we're going to have a discussion group, but you guys can't sit together. Because every time you do that, you end up having this big, long discussion about Christian things, and that's not what I want. That spilled over into biology, where I was in AP Biology and we're having discussions on whether or not evolution was true. The same group of people still claiming to be Christians, most of them going to church, and almost all of them believing that evolution was true. I remember going on a biology field trip one time, this AP biology field trip, and we're walking around the zoo. I don't know why they took us to the zoo. I guess we're supposed to do some kind of project. But we didn't really do, I think we did the project. But we spent our whole time looking at the animals, and then we were, again, having this loud discussion as to how that could possibly have evolved. So I'd be like, now how could that evolve? And they'd be like, well, here's how it works. And they'd be telling me about it as we walk around the zoo. Finally, our teacher had to come up to us and say, look, right, you are not living according to the spirit of this project. You need to stop talking about this. Because that was a great challenge to my faith. But it was also a chance for me to try to interact in relationship with people and state strongly what I believe, try to keep from being unduly influenced by them, but also remain friends with them. And by God's grace, he enabled me to do that. And so I had this whole group of friends who were wrestling with their own Christian faith, and I had the privilege of having the training necessary to be with them and help them along in some of those areas. Now, I was stretched myself. And I remember writing back to my youth pastor in California, a guy named Rocky Wyatt, who is the guy I do a lot of ministry with now. And I remember writing back and saying, you know what, Rocky, I'm scared. Because this is a difficult thing. My youth group then and the church that I was going to was very weak. Most of them were not. They were either new believers or weren't really believers. And so I wasn't getting much support there. And I remember writing back saying, you know what, this is a fine line I'm walking here as to how I am able to share and will I be swayed and how much I need to walk with the Lord. I have that letter. I kept it. I forgot that I couldn't find it, so I couldn't bring it tonight. But I wrote it. I remember writing back to him and saying, you know what, this relationship thing is difficult. Now, you guys, we're going to talk about two different kinds of relationships tonight. We're going to talk about friendship relationships, and then we're going to talk about those kinds of relationships that move past friendship, guy-girl relationships. Some call it dating. Some, there's a variety of other things that it's called. We're going to talk about both of those, but the bottom line is the basic issues in relationship, either friendship or moving past that into dating, the issues remain the same. Will we be godly? Will we make Christ the center of that relationship? Will we act Christ-like in the relationship? And will we be careful in our relationships so that they do not lead us away from Christ? How are you going to do that? So that's what we're going to talk about tonight and these principles that we're going to apply. Because I am so thankful for both my parents, particularly my mom in my life, and then a faithful youth pastor who would come alongside of me and say and build into me principles of relationship that I was able to hold on to when I was pushed in those. Now, most of you young people have parents who are doing that, who have already done that. My goal is to come alongside them in that task so that you are able to face the difficult relational challenges that you will face, because they will come. In fact, I would imagine that for some of you, they are already here. But you are wrestling with how you relate to others, and particularly those who are maybe struggling in their Christian walk, or those who aren't believers at all, and how it is that you deal with them and love them and yet remain strong. We're going to talk about some of that. So what I'd like us to see tonight is that God has provided us relationships in order to exercise holiness in helping others conform to the image of Christ. God has provided us relationships in order to exercise holiness in helping others conform to the image of Christ. A, developing friendship relationships. Okay, developing friendship relationships. And it is my intent tonight, it's always my intent, I guess, to cover lots of material, but particularly here, because I want to get this out. All right, I want to get this out. We could have done just the weekend on this. All right, but I want to get a lot of this out there so that you have a chance to chew over it and talk about it and think about it as families. All right, friendship relationships. One, what I've called the principle of position. I've just tried to draw out some principles from Scripture. The principle of position. We must not put ourselves in a position where we are under the strong influence of unsaved friends. We must never put ourselves in the position where we are under the strongest influence of those who are unbelievers. Turn to Psalm 1. Now again, for most of you right now, this is, well, I would say for many of you right now, this is maybe not necessarily an issue. You kind of are somewhat protected in your, possibly, in kind of the homeschool group of people that you are around. Many of them would claim to be believers and other things. But I would challenge you that even within that group, there are many who claim to be believers who probably aren't, who certainly are not acting like it. So being homeschooled or having that is no guarantee that you are not going to be unduly or improperly influenced. Going to a Christian school is not going to guarantee that you don't get influenced by unbelieving people who claim to be believers, who don't know any better, or who do know better and are using the name but aren't. And if you go to a public school, certainly you are going to be wrestling with this issue of how do I deal with all of these unbelievers. And this principle of position is incredibly important for you. Psalm 1:1, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. You must learn that your close friendships have to be those where Christ is lifted up, where the principles of God are able to be talked about and explained and worked on with you guys together. If you don't have those kinds of friendships, then you are going to be in serious trouble. You just need to understand that. That is a principle from Scripture. You are not blessed if you walk in the counsel of the wicked, stand in the path of sinners, sit in the seat of scoffers. And an unbeliever, that's what an unbeliever is. An unbeliever can never be one who does less than scoff at God because they have not chosen to yield themselves to Christ. So they are scoffers, right? They are wicked. They are sinners. And we don't like to think of our friends like that. But if they haven't bent the knee to Christ, that's what they are. And there is no way around it. There's nothing they can do to make a change unless they come to Christ. And you can't pretend that it's some way different. So, A, you must not walk in the counsel of the wicked. And you kind of see the progression here. Did you have A underneath that? All right. And it's already filled out for you? All right. You must not walk in the counsel of the wicked. Psalm 64:2 says, hide me from the secret counsel of evildoers, from the tumult of those who do iniquity, who have sharpened their tongue like a sword. They embitter speech as their arrow to shoot from concealment at the blameless. Suddenly they shoot at him, and they do not fear. Because unbelievers, by the very nature of what they say and do, whether their personal intent is to drag you away from Christ, that is what Satan will use that for. That is how that will work. Because they are not able to guide you towards him, and so the things that they do will pull you away. So it's kind of, he says, they do not walk in the counsel of the wicked. It's almost as though you kind of gather people around you and you're walking and you're starting to listen to them, you're kind of drawing them around. Maybe they're just buds or you like to talk with them or you kind of like what they do, and you're kind of walking with them and they're talking with you and you're starting to be influenced by them. Well, the next step is this: you must not stand in the path of sinners. So you begin to walk with them. There's almost a picture, word picture laid out for us here. You're kind of walking and starting to draw around you maybe people that are giving you poor influences, but all of a sudden you're starting to like what you hear because it appeals to your flesh. It appeals to the things, that old man that we talked about that you got to put off, and they start to appeal to that, and you've begun to develop a bond. And that friendship relationship that you begin to develop enhances your desire to listen to what they say. Please understand that. You may think, well, I would never do that. I would never, say those things or do those things. A bond of friendship that you develop with someone is a very powerful means of your beginning to imitate them. That bond of friendship. And so it's almost like the walking stops and you begin to stand. And now you are regularly where sinners are. And remember, a sinner is just someone in this context who doesn't know Christ. It's not a really bad sinner. It's just someone who doesn't know Jesus, who has not professed Christ, who has not been changed on the inside. So don't stand in the path or walk in the path of the wicked, walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners. Proverbs 1:15 says, my son, do not walk in the way with them, that is, evil men. Keep your feet from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed blood. Now again, I know you might be thinking, well, my friends don't shed blood. What are you talking about? You guys, an unbeliever, again, his sin or her sin is that they do not honor the God of the universe. And therefore, they would draw you into not honoring the God of the universe. And there is no worse sin than that. None. It doesn't matter what exactly they are doing. They will draw you away. Do not walk in the counsel of the wicked, stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. You see the progression. So now you are sitting. Whereas before, you were just kind of walking, all of a sudden you slowed down and you started to stand, and now you are sitting, which indicates that you have become one of them. You have become like them. And it is possible for believers to be sitting in that scoffer seat. I don't believe it's possible for them to stay there all of their lives. It's going to be a battle in their nature, but the bottom line is you can scoff. And you can spend a period of your life doing that where you are actually saying, well, maybe those things aren't true about God, or maybe those things that my parents said I don't want to do, maybe I don't want to, you know, maybe I don't really want to obey what I find in the Word. That's scoffing against God. And that's what happens when you gather around you people that influence you in that way, because you must be very careful. This principle of position is huge. And I'm not talking about just now. I'm talking for the rest of your life. I'm talking about how you pick a church. I'm talking about how you determine who you're going to have spend time with you. This is huge and will determine the course of your life, your friendships, those that you choose to be in intimate relationship with. Because the bottom line is, for those of you who are not married, which is the majority of you here, is that you will find your lifelong mate out of that group of people that you chose to surround yourself with. And there is a great danger that you would find for your lifelong mate a scoffer, someone who does not truly love God. You cannot afford to play with this. This principle of position is huge, and it has led many astray who have not followed it. Now, the positive side of this principle of position is that you must walk with the wise. You must not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but you are called to walk with the wise. Proverbs 13:20. Now, this verse you've probably heard, you probably know it, but it's scripture. It's absolutely true. It's a scriptural principle that can never be thwarted. Proverbs 13:20 says, he who walks with wise men will be what? Wise. The companion of fools suffers harm. This is an absolute biblical principle. It cannot ever be violated. If you walk with wise men, in Proverbs, who is a wise man? Proverbs 1:7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, I'm not talking, I think they're a Christian. Yeah, I mean, they said some Christian things once. Yeah, Mom, they're pretty nice people. You know, I hang out with them. They're not bad people. They're pretty good. Are they believers? You know, I think so, probably so. You guys, someone who fears the Lord is obvious. You don't have to wait, you know, 6 months before you determine whether or not they fear the Lord. Someone who fears the Lord, it's clear. Now, this is a challenge, and my challenge is to you. If people hung around you for 4 or 5 days, would they know you fear the Lord? Or would you just seem like everybody else? See, one who fears the Lord honors him. He talks about it because he loves him. Or she loves the Lord, and it's quickly on their lips saying, wow, that's pretty radical. It's not radical. Not scripturally. This is who we are. We are those who love and honor God. That's the wise man. But the companion of fools will suffer harm. Who's a fool in Proverbs?
Someone who does not fear God.
Someone who does not, the flip side, does not honor God. Acts as though God does not exist. Does not take into account the principles of God and the character of God. So this principle of position is huge. Second, there's a principle of purpose. A principle of purpose. Our friends, our close friends. Okay, and again, I'm not yet talking about the friendship relationships we develop in order to win people to Christ. That's a different issue, and that's not really for tonight. Those are necessary, right? And we will do that as we are in the world, as part of what I was able to do by God's grace when I was in 11th and 12th grade. We're not talking about that yet. Principle of purpose, our close friends must be those who have the same purpose as we do to serve Jesus. We must not be bound together with unbelievers. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Don't be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership hath righteousness and lawlessness? What fellowship hath light with darkness? What harmony has Christ with Belial? What has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement has the temple of God with idols? Therefore, come out from among them and be separate. It doesn't mean that we aren't with unbelievers. It means that we don't partner with them in spiritual endeavor, in walking with God, in our primary purpose of glorifying God. We find people to partner with who have the same purpose we do, which is to honor and please God. Those have to be your close friends. If they're not your close friends, you're dead. You're not gonna want to serve and glorify God for very long. Again, I'm talking about those that you are cultivating to be those whom you want to share intimate time with and have close fellowship with. I'm not talking about those that are in your general sphere of influence, and again, those that you might be working with as a means of talking to them about Christ. So they don't be bound together with unbelievers, and you must be pursuing God. 2 Timothy 2:22. 2 Timothy 2:22. Now flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace along with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. Oh, did you hear that?
Now flee from youthful lust, pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Does that sound to you like a nominal Christian? Someone who just says the name of Jesus and doesn't have anything to do with Christ the rest of the time? Who call on the Lord from a pure heart. That is to be your group of friends. And unfortunately, that's a pretty small sphere of influence. And we're going to talk about it in a minute. If that's not your heart, then you certainly aren't going to draw that group of friends. You can't go find them if that's not what you want to do. So that's why I talked about personal holiness first, holiness and culture and those other things first, because if those things aren't there, these friendship principles are never going to get enacted by you. And you're never going to walk with wise men because you're going to gather around yourself foolish men because you are a foolish person. Pursue God. Three, the principle of persecution. The principle of persecution. A choice of godly friendships will always result in persecution. You see, so often what we want is we just want life to be easy. So we want to pick friends and do things that make our life easy. Because when you choose godly friends and when you choose to work with people and draw close to you, people who love God, you're going to suffer persecution from that. The world doesn't like that. And you're going to end up, as you seek to be godly, coming underneath the persecution of the world. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 1. It says, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. Because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desires of the Gentiles, having pursued, of course, of sensuality, sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Sounds a lot like our modern high school and college scene, doesn't it? Things don't change. Now listen carefully. And in all this, that is those sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousals, in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation and they malign you. Simply put, you don't do that sinful stuff with them and so they come after you. Why aren't you doing this? Why? What are you, holier than thou? Some kind of hoity-toity? What, you're not going to do these things with us? At whatever level that sensuality might be. Some it's little, some it's much. And they say, why aren't you doing this? I mean, does this not sound like for some every day where you're wrestling with these things? And they're coming and saying, they're surprised that you don't run with them into this kind of excess. But then the last part of that verse says, they are surprised when you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation and they malign you, but they shall give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. You see, whether or not they malign you is not the issue. You are not their judge. And they are not your judge. God is their judge and yours. You guys, do not allow your friends to be your judge. Which means, well, you should do this or you should do that. And so you base your standard of what you do on what your friends determine is right or wrong. They're not going to judge you on the last day. God is. And you're not going to judge them on the last day. God is. There's a higher standard. And the standard is God. And this works in groups where Christians are all gathered together and where Christians and unbelievers are gathered together. Principle of persecution, when you choose godly friendships, you will pay a price. It's worth it, but you will pay a price for that. Four, principle of preparation. We must be specially prepared to minister to the unsaved through friendship. Now here's where we're moving into a different arena. If you have put these other principles into practice, then Colossians 4, verse 5 begins to apply to you. Colossians 4, 5 says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Notice, outsiders, those of you who have not allowed into close fellowship with you. Technically, that's outside the church. Because the church should not be, members of the church should not be in close fellowship with unbelievers or those acting like unbelievers. So those outside, it says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards them, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person. You'll have a greater sphere of influence where there are unbelievers. And if those other principles are in place for you, you will then be able to recognize them as outsiders, recognize that they need Christ and are not the same as you, and then use your speech wisely to begin to influence them to tell them about Jesus. And so as you do this, you will be constantly naming the name of Jesus. You will be loving them as Jesus would. You will be going in strength to them, which is with other believers and the support of a solid church. You will draw them into your world. You will not go into theirs, and you will point them to Jesus. You see, when you start to say to unbelievers, come to my world. Let me show you what Jesus is like. Let me show you what it means to love Jesus. Let me show you a life that's committed to Jesus. And if they want to come and see that, that is a beautiful thing. If they don't want to come and see that, then you may not go. Again, you can go out and say, would you like to see what Jesus looks like? If they reject that and say, well, no, you need to come to my side. You need to do what I do. You need to join my culture. You must reject that. You must. You shine the light. Those that God is not drawing, run. Those that God is drawing, come into that light. You stay in the light. They come towards the light, and then you're able to minister them. But you cannot do it opposite. Turning off the light, they come to gather around you because there is no light, and then, bink, you sneak it on a little bit later. Usually then, it's too late. You've already given over to their way of thinking and their way of life. And then five, the principle of persistence. The principle of persistence. Stick with your friendships, you guys. They can last a lifetime and be a source of stability and hope in a difficult world. We are a world that throws away friendships. Now, there's a variety of ways in which this applies. You should be developing a friendship with your parents. You are young adults. You are of age. It is your job to begin to initiate with them in a way that draws them into a friendship relationship with you. It doesn't change their authority relationship over you. Okay? You don't put away that. But it changes now. Before, they've just dictated to you, this is what you do and this is how it is. Now you are supposed to be initiating a friendship with them where you share interests with them, where you care about what they care about, where you talk to them about things that they might like, not just what you like, where you begin to try to develop with them an intimacy that goes beyond just, you do this, you're my son, okay, Dad, I'll do this. Dad, what do you like? How are you doing today? How can I pray for you? Can we get together and talk about things or go do something together that we would both enjoy? Dad with dad, or dad with son, and son with mom with daughter, dad with daughter. You are to develop this, and that is to be a precious relationship for you. But guys, also other relationships with your siblings, it works the same way. You should be developing a friendship relationship with them. And then also, there are some precious relationships that you are establishing, maybe even now, outside of your family, that you should learn to hold on to for as long as God will allow you to be together, but then hoping that you develop a strong enough core that for years to come, you will be able to benefit from an ongoing relationship, even if it's at a distance. And I know that I've shared with you, but I'll share it again. When I was away at this XL conference, there was about 150 people there. Probably of that many, there was probably 20 of them. A smaller group, there's probably 10 of them whom I've known for over 20 years. That's precious to me. And I gather together, we get together with them, and what the Lord has done in our lives over those 20 to 25 years is a precious blessing. You guys, I'm thankful to the Lord that I've been able to hold on to some of those precious friendships. Do not be in our microwave culture, which just says, well, quick friendship, boom, and no commitment, no establishing ties. Principle of persistence, you stick with your friendships. You don't discard friends. You don't just leave them behind. When the next friend comes along and someone cooler comes along or someone you think is nicer comes along, you don't discard friends. And you don't discard the members of the body of Christ. They are to be your friends. Guys, this is huge. The world doesn't live this way. They just discard people and leave them lying along the road. We cannot do this. So guys, these are principles of friendship. Are there more? Yes. Could we talk more about these? Yes. But guys, here's my challenge. What are your friendships like? Are they selfish, shallow, self-centered, short? Or are they deep, committed, Christ-like? Do you even think about that? Or just go, hey, we like video games, so we're friends. That doesn't make a friendship. Shared interests do not make a friendship. They may help you come together in relationship, but they don't make a friendship. Shared purpose makes a friendship. We are in this to do the same thing, to glorify God, to honor Him, to love Him. That's what makes a friendship. Not just a shared, hey, we like to do this, we like to go rock climbing, we like to do these things. Guys, that just puts two people together. It doesn't make them friends. godly friends. All right, now we're going to move to something that I call developing dating relationships. That's B. When I say developing dating relationships, all kinds of warning bells go off in your head, and all different kinds of words, particularly parents, all kinds of different words that you've heard. All right, I'm simply going to use dating in the most generic of terms, which is a dating relationship is one that moves past a guy-guy friendship or a guy-girl friendship or even a guy a girl-girl friendship, even a guy-girl friendship that just simply is we enjoy being with one another and begins to move in the direction of marriage. That's all I'm going to define that as. All right. I'm going to use the word dating to do that. Don't get mad at me for that. That's just what I'm going to do. Right? Because all the other words, I could pick a bunch of other things. It gets all confusing. And when I say another word like courtship or other things, you get this whole system that you see revolved around that I have to wade through. I'm not going to wade through it. I'm just going to say dating relationships are those that move beyond or begin to have with their intent the purpose of marriage. That's how I'm going to define it. The world doesn't define it that way. That's how I'm going to define it. All right? So what are, first, let's talk about this world, the world system of relationships to do this. How does the world say that you should develop relationships which move past the friendship level into what is the progression towards marriage? One, the world does this in a way that is selfish. So the world system of relationships is always selfish. Worldly dating, notice I put the adjective in front of it, leads to intimacy but not commitment. Right, developing and deepening intimacy without any level of commitment is extremely dangerous. Intimacy with God is based on commitment to God. Intimacy with others is based on commitment to them. And so what the world system does is demands a majority of attention and time and leaves no room for other friendships or other activities. It seeks complete loyalty and devotion, and it does this too early. That's what the world does. Second, the world's dating relationships are shallow. Worldly dating relationships are shallow. They skip entirely past the friendship stage. One-on-one relationships move us past friendship towards romance, what we call romance, too quickly. Worldly dating says, I'm interested in you. Let's get to know each other. Friendship says we're interested in the same things. Let's enjoy those common interests and then deep into a common purpose. Worldly dating doesn't do that at all. People get together. Hey, you going out with someone? You know, are you in a relationship? You know, the Facebook thing, in, you know, where it says, how are you related? I'm in a relationship. Okay, you guys, the issue is not simply are you in a relationship, but what kind of relationship and how, what's the bottom line structure of that? With the world, it's always shallow. I just want to get into a relationship. Next, it's always, always sensual. Sensual. Worldly dating relationships mistake a physical relationship for love. The first and foremost goal of worldly dating relationships is to have a good time. No relationship will survive on that foundation. A friendship relationship won't either. But certainly not a relationship that might move towards marriage. Hey, let's just have a good time. Because no relationship can function with just having a good time as its priority. It breeds selfishness, pride, and immorality. And this sensuality essentially leads to the idea that anything is okay as long as you have feelings for someone. So once my affections get moved in the direction of someone else, then hey, I can pursue a relationship with them because my affections are moved in that direction. You are the one who is to determine how your affections move or to work with your affections so that you change them. Now they may spring to your heart, oh, I really like that person, or my affections begin to be moving towards that person. It is up to you to understand how you change your affections. Sometimes that means removal. Sometimes that means there's a variety of things that can mean. But the world is just simply sensual. A person's primary value in the worldly system comes from how they look, how they perform, what good things they can do. D, the world's dating relationships are single-minded. They isolate from every other kind of relationship. They're exclusive. They leave no way to break off without anger or hurt. And surely this is not God's plan. Where you say, look, just you and I, we're together. You guys, when that's not the right time or the right place for that commitment, you're not allowed to make that. You don't have the right to say it's just you and I. There's the whole body of Christ. Even ultimately, a marriage relationship is not it's just you and I. There still are others that are around that. So we are not allowed to become, and you must never become, simply single-minded in your relationships. It's just this one person and me, and I start to put away everything else to focus on them. The worldly dating relationships are solitary. They seek above all else to find time alone where no one else is present. You see that happen, don't you? We're going to pair off and we need to go find time by ourselves. Look, you know, we're dating. We're in a relationship. And so we got to have time by ourselves. Where is that written? It's not written anywhere. Who says you have any right to have time by yourselves? Just you with someone else. It's not a biblical principle. And yet it's so often sought by those who are getting into this kind of relationship. It's deadly. As you move away from accountability, and as you move towards this solitary theme where you're just going to be away and by yourself. And I often ask those, particularly I ask, I'll ask couples who are engaged, say, you know, do you spend time at one another's home together with no one there? Sure we do, we're engaged. Why do you do that? Well, hey, we're adults and we can do that. You're in big trouble. Because you're moving into a realm that you're not accountable. When you're married, great, be alone together, it's wonderful. It's not wonderful to tell them. So solitary is where the world's relationships want to go. Watch any movie, any Disney movie on up. You get together in a relationship, what happens? You get to be away by yourself. It's not a right. You don't deserve it. That's what the world says. That's not what the Lord says. Short-sighted is another thing that the worldly dating relationships are. Short-sighted. It distracts you from the primary responsibility of preparing for the future. This focuses exclusively on this one relationship, and then you stop to develop the other kinds of skills that you need. So this one-on-one pairing off begins to keep you from developing the other kind of things that you need to develop as a young man or a young woman. It is G, satisfaction challenged. I guess I've given you some of these, not all of them. I needed another S, so satisfaction challenge worked. It causes discontent with God's gift of singleness. Did you guys know that right now, all the young people here, God has given you a gift? You know what your gift is? One of them is to be single. Right? You have a gift of singleness because you have to be single until such time as you get married. And you can't get married right now, at least the vast majority of you. It's not time. And so you have been given this gift, and oftentimes people are discontent. Oh, I see this all over the place. I've got to get into a relationship. Why? Where is it written? I must have one. But everything from every movie and every song and every worldly person you see, what are they saying? You got to have a relationship. Do you have one? Are you pairing off with someone? Do you know someone? Who are you getting to know? Who are you working towards a relationship with? It's the pressure is intense beyond belief. Beginning in grade school and working its way up. And it causes you to be dissatisfied with what God has given you now, which is singleness, that you might develop your character so that you might prepare for one day being married. It is superficial. Worldly dating is superficial. It creates an environment that is artificial, and so you can't evaluate someone's character properly. You know the best way to evaluate someone's character? Is to watch them from a distance. I don't mean so far that you can't see what they're doing, but somewhere like a youth group is a pretty great place. Because you watch them when they're on a retreat like this, and when someone says, hey, it's time to clean up, and boom, they're gone. And you're watching, and you're going, I'm not sure that's great character. Now, you might check to see, maybe it's just that time, maybe they'd volunteered for KP the day before. So you're not making judgments the first time you see someone. You're spending time watching from afar to see what it is that they're really like when they don't really know anybody's watching them. Because, see, once you begin to zero your attention in on them, they try to figure out what you want, and they want to give it to you. And that's just natural. That's what we do. So watch them from somewhere where they may not necessarily know. And now you guys are all scared. Like, everybody's watching me. Yes, and that's good. Yes, and that's very, very good. Right? Because you should be watching each other to see what each other's character is like so that you can help each other. It's not for the purpose of simply, well, maybe that's a person I can marry. Now, that's great. Right? That's a wonderful thing. But it is for the purpose of helping and encouraging and building them up. So worldly dating is superficial. It simply puts an environment in which you can't really properly evaluate someone's character. It tends to be very superior, as my last S. It causes people to feel superior and causes them to challenge authority. Now, once people decide they want to have this kind of worldly dating relationship, if the parents get in the way, what happens? It's my right. Why are you keeping me from what it is that I should do? So it becomes a superior mindset of, well, I should be able to dictate to you how my relationships should go. And that, again, is patently anti-biblical. So you are trying to develop relationships that don't make you think that somehow you should be able to challenge your parents into doing things that they have said that you may not do and should not do. It's huge. The world system is set up to do all of these things. You must not, cannot mimic it. Worldly day. Now, what does a godly system of relationships look like? That would be number two. God's system of relationships. And I've chosen that word carefully. Ephesians 4:22 says that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lust of deceit. You be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and you put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. Now, I'm going to give you these. I'm really going to just read to you because I want to step into this last portion in just a minute. So God's system of relationships. Here are the baselines for what God says should go on in a relationship. A is love. Every relationship is an opportunity to model the love of Christ. And so not a fake, flirtatious love, which attracts attention to ourselves and gets a reaction from the person that we currently like. We must not invest more energy in getting a guy or girl to like us than in spurring them on to godliness. When you love someone, you're not trying to get them interested in you. You're trying to get them interested in God. That's huge. That's the baseline of every relationship you have. Next is contentment. God's system of relationships allows us to be content in the relationships and with the relationships we have. Your unmarried years are a gift from God. We must not operate from a worldly dating mindset, which says we're incomplete without having that kind of relationship. You're not incomplete. You're as complete as God desires for you to be. There will come a time when you begin to pursue that kind of relationship in the right time, in the right way. But when it's not the right time and not the right way, you are totally complete. So contentment is part of every relationship that we are to have. We're content with what God has given. C is character. Intimacy is the reward of commitment. We don't need to pursue romantic relationships before we're ready in a position to be married, either character-wise or simply life-wise. We don't need to. It's not time. It's not necessary. God has made you for intimacy. Listen to me carefully. And he will someday provide it when it's right and with the right person. You don't have to get in his way to say, I got to get this now. He has made you to be intimate. He has. The vast majority of you, he's made you to be married. But he will bring it in the right time and in the right way. So you're developing your character, you're being content, you're demonstrating and learning love in every relationship that you have, and then D is true commitment. Commitment. You don't own someone outside of marriage. Now, when you are inside of marriage, it says that the husband owns the wife, her body, essentially, and the wife owns the husband. God owns them both. But you know what? Until that happens, you don't own anybody. There is no right for them to have you or to get you to do, no right whatsoever. Anything outside of marriage. There is married and not married. There is no middle stage called in relationship. None. It's a phantom. It doesn't exist. It's married or not married. So commitment is what you are learning to build and develop so that you can give it in the right and proper way. And then purity. Purity is another aspect of all relationships that we have with others, that we avoid any situation that would compromise the purity of our mind or body. Purity is not just remaining a virgin until you get married. It is a whole mindset, a direction, a lifestyle. And when, where, and with whom you spend to choose to spend your time reveals your true commitment to purity. How do you spend your time? What do you listen to? What do you watch? Who are you with? Will reveal whether or not you're actually committed to this. I rarely have anyone ask me, how holy is too holy in relationships? Rarely have anyone come up. I've had people ask me, say, well, how far is too far? It's absolutely the wrong question. It shouldn't even be asked. How far can I go and still not sin? How about asking this? How holy could I possibly be in this relationship? Chris, could you, Mom, Dad, could you tell me? Is there anything I'm doing in this relationship that could possibly lead to any kind of unholiness? Would you tell me to stop? I want to stay as far away from that as I possibly can. That should be always your question. There is, and how holy is too holy? You can't possibly be too holy in a relationship. doing proper godly things. You can't be too holy, but you certainly can begin to work towards sinfulness. I know you've probably heard the illustration. We were just driving to Colorado, and when we drove over the $1 million highway, a lot of those 10,000-foot passes don't have any guardrails on the side of the roads. I still don't know why they do that. All right. Now, I love the beauty of the mountains, but I don't want to get so close to it that I'm rolling my car down in it. And so I don't drive on the side of the road to say, oh, hey, dear, watch this. I'll show you how close I can get. So I'm right there on the edge. No, I kind of hug the inside because I don't want to go over the edge. And as we consider what holiness is, and really the illustration breaks down because if you're being holy, it's not like you're staying away from something. You're approaching God, which is not holding yourself back from anything if you're seeking to be holy. Now, you might be saying, well, okay, then what do I do? If you're telling me that I shouldn't be in this one-on-one kind of relationship the way the world does it, if I shouldn't have this kind of worldly dating relationship, what should I be doing? Well, let me give you some thoughts. Is that okay? All right, hang with me here for a minute. Actively waiting for a godly relationship. So I'm just going to give you a series of things that you should be doing now to prepare for the time when you will be married. Now, let me ask you, how many actually want to be married? You're thinking, and you actually want to be. Okay, we got one honest person over here. We got two. All right, it's okay to want to be married. That's fine. In fact, that's a really great thing. So in wanting that, all right, now I'm going to try to help lay for you a blueprint of how you move in that direction. Because I want you to move in that direction. I want you, every one of you whom God has called to do this, and again, that's probably 99% of you, I want every one of you in a godly, joyous, beautiful, lifelong relationship. I'm not trying to keep you from anything, and neither are your parents when it comes to a lifelong, godly, beautiful relationship. I want to see you in it. I don't want to see you in a disaster. So, what are you going to do? Actively waiting for a godly relationship, you're going to develop your own maturity and character. You're going to develop your own maturity and character. You're going to learn what it looks like to be pleasing to the Lord. Ephesians 5, 7 through 15. What we can't know must not hinder us from acting on what we do know. We know that we have today to move with energy towards maturity and Christ-likeness. We hustle while we wait. We actively wait by developing our character in every way possible. Are you a liar? Man, you need to stop. Because if you get in a marriage relationship, you're going to destroy it with lying. Are you a manipulator? Man, you need to stop. Because if you get into a marriage relationship, you're going to destroy people with your manipulation. Are you a whiner? You need to stop. You're gonna crush a marriage with whining. See what I mean? You need to be developing your character. And you need to be asking people, how do I do that? We can't ignore our current responsibilities and character qualities and expect to magically gain the strength and character of virtue that will make us good husbands and wives. It doesn't happen by magic. It happens by the grace of God working through diligent effort to be holy. So you are developing character. B, practice intimacy with your family. This is Ephesians 6, 1 and 3. I can't read all the verses. But you're going to practice intimacy with your family. Again, guys, this is so important. When was the last time you sat down with your parents and had a good intimate discussion with them? Now, I tell you this with all of my heart. If you cannot sit down with the ones who love you the most in the world and have a good, deep conversation with them, what in the world makes you think you're ever going to be able to do it with someone else? When I meet that special person, we'll just love each other so much that we'll be intimate. No, you won't. No, you won't. It takes tremendous amount of work and commitment and care. If you're not exerting it now with your parents and with your siblings and with your other friends, you're not developing what you need. Practice intimacy now with your family and properly with your friends of the same gender in the proper kinds of ways. Because if you're not doing it now, you're not going to do it later. Practice seeking God with others. Well, I've talked a lot about that, so I won't spend much time on it. Now, what makes you think that in a marriage, and probably all of you would raise your hand and say, I want my marriage to be centered on Christ. Anybody here that would disagree with that? No, because if you did, then I'd be mad at you and your parents would. You know. Are your current friendship relationships centered on Christ? Is your relationship with your parents and siblings centered on Christ? It's not going to magically happen when you find that nice, that beautiful someone. It's not going to happen. Practice financial responsibility. What? Practice financial responsibility. How many of you make some kind of money each week or each month? How many of you get money from some source? Okay? Almost all of you. How do you use that money? Some of you are going, I don't get any money. Why do all these other people get money? What's going on? Well, talk to your parents. It's not my fault, all right? Almost all of you get money in some way or the other. Are you good with it? Do you know what causes tremendous devastation in marriages? People who are bad with money. They're selfish. They're foolish. They're impulsive. Are you like that with your money? It's not going to magically change when you get married. Practice financial responsibility. Now, take this next one carefully. Practice parenthood. All right, now what I mean by that is learn what it takes, observing your parents to see what it takes to be a good mom and a good dad in dealing with children. Many of you have that privilege or that opportunity. Some of you don't. Get involved in the nursery if it's appropriate for you to do that. Learn how to deal with babies and with children. Learn how to do some of those things. Practice that now. You're not going to magically become a good mom or dad. It kind of takes work. Ask your mom or dad. All right? They know. Practice parenthood. Practice practical life skills. Cooking, shopping, planning menus. Car maintenance. Oh, man. Unfortunately, my dad's view of car maintenance was check the oil every once in a while. And one time he sent me out to check the oil, and we had two cars, and I pulled up the dipstick, and both of them were empty. There was no oil on the dipstick. That was how I was raised. And so I had a lot of work to do to try to figure out how I do any kind of maintenance. I don't think that's happened to me yet. But just ask the people that come and help me and save me when I blow projects in the middle and I have to call them and say, what do I do? I think I was changing the brakes one time and I just could not get this thing back together. And Scott, he didn't come over just for that, but he wanders by. I said, Scott, I can't get this brake back together. He looks at it for about 5 seconds and he points it. He goes, do you see the spring? It's supposed to be connected here. Oh, thank you. All right, I'd spent about half an hour trying to do that. But he goes, practice those things. Learn how to do that stuff. Practical life skills. Gee, build a biblical view of marriage. Build a biblical view of marriage. You see, a wedding is an event, but a marriage is a state of being. It's not a one-time act. It's a lifelong commitment. And so you should learn what marriage is like. Talk to your parents. What is a marriage? It's a supernatural union between a man and a woman, if it's a believing marriage, that represents Christ and the church. It's not just two people hanging out together for the rest of their lives. It has meaning deep. Parents, are you going over this with your kids? Have you sat down with them to say, no, marriage is this. It is a picture of Christ in the church. Here's how we're trying to model that for you. Here's what it looks like. Are you starting that now, showing them what it looks like and telling them what it looks like? And have you talked, parents, to your children about the refinement of marriage? That you step into marriage and you find out that you're an idiot. You find out that you're selfish. You find out that you're foolish and you hate it. And you either respond by being sullen and withdrawn, or you respond by being repentant and deepening. Tell your children this, because they look at what they see at marriages and sometimes even at yours, and they don't understand the cost, but that it's a joyful one, but that it will rip away from them their selfishness and sinfulness and their right to do whatever they want. What do teenagers want to do more than anything else in all of life? What they want. You know what? It goes away in marriage. And it should go away for you as a teenager. It's got to go away or you're going to destroy your marriage. It's refining beyond belief, but it makes you look like Jesus if it's a Christ-committed marriage. Develop an understanding of the character qualities needed in a life mate. Develop an understanding of the character qualities needed in a life mate. 1 Samuel 16:7 says, God looks not at the outward appearance, but at the heart. You need to be looking at the heart of and trying to analyze, how do you analyze the heart of someone that you would want to get into a marriage relationship with ultimately? You guys, what's going to matter at 50? And it's not necessarily how their hair reflects the light. All right? Now, that may still be important at 50. All right, but you know what? That's probably not going to be it. Right? Whether they will be committed to you is probably a little more important. Whether they're still going to love Jesus, or whether they are not lazy, it's going to be a little bit more important than if, you know, they look really good in their graduation photo. Okay? Character is a variety of things. Okay? How a person relates to God. Right? I don't know if you have this on your outline. No, you don't. Okay. But I'll just run through some things. How a person relates to others. Be watching for these things. What kind of personal discipline do they have? Okay? What kind of attitudes do they have? Are they humble? Are they hardworking? Do they know how to use their time? Do they know how to take care of themselves? Do they respond properly to authorities? Do they respond properly to members of the opposite sex? What kind of a friend are they? One of those unbelieving friends that I had in high school one time took me out. It was midway through my 11th grade year with that group of friends that I said that I had, and she looked me in the eye and she said, "You are a terrible friend." I said, "What? I'm a great guy. I'm fun to be with. You know, I'm talking about Jesus." I didn't say it quite like that. She said, "No, you quickly turn away from people. You don't pay much attention to them. You're not a very good friend." And you know what? In many ways, she was right. I wasn't. I was superficial, shallow, and focused on myself, even though I was trying to be an example for Christ. I was still sinful. And so I had to learn to change that. And when she confronted me on that, I didn't want to make a change. I just got mad at her. But by God's grace, it helped me to recognize my own foolishness. You also need to develop many godly relationships. Develop many godly relationships, not many godly relationships. All right. All right, many. Be a good friend. Develop a lot of relationships. Get to know a lot of different people. Now I'm going to step you through one more thing. All right? And this I'm just going to lay out as a bit of a pattern here. We're not going to talk about it much. Okay, develop a plan. This is when now you are in a position in life when you can actually begin to pursue marriage. When is that position? Is that in high school? Who of you can get married in high school? Unless it's a very unusual situation. All right? So this is not for high school. And even for some in college, it's not for that. So you're going to have to talk with your parents, develop when it's the proper time. But here's a little bit what this looks like. A, casual friendship. Okay? Each time you feel attracted to someone, remember that you're involved in three kinds of relationships. Your relationship with the person you're interested in, your relationship with the people around you, including family and friends, and your relationship with God. You have to determine, should I be attracted to this person? Is this appropriate? Is this the proper person to be attracted to? If it isn't, what are you going to have to do? If it's not the right person to be attracted to, what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to move yourself away from them. Because it's very hard to turn off attraction. The way you're going to have to do that is by removing yourself from where you are with them very often. If that's not at all possible, you have a harder battle, but usually it is. You're going to have to change your affections. Now, this is very hard. So you need to be very careful of the kinds of people you surround yourself with closely, because turning affections on and off, they come unbidden. You have to learn to manage them. So you're going to have to say, no, it's not appropriate. Oh, but my heart says it's appropriate. Your heart doesn't say that at all. Your sinful nature says that. You're going to have to learn to undo that. You need to start practicing some of that now. If there's those that, even now, things that you're attracted to that you have affections for that you shouldn't, you're going to have to practice turning those affections. So a casual friendship, you've got to determine, is this even appropriate, this casual friendship? And if I start having feelings, remember, this is when this becomes appropriate, which is not now in high school. Is this even appropriate for me to have a deeper attraction to this person? And then it becomes a deeper friendship. It becomes a deeper friendship, not yet an exclusive one in any way, just simply a deeper friendship. And you begin to consider possibly what their character qualities are, and even more deeply. You assume your proper biblical roles in this. You're careful of your conversation. Okay? You're committed to walking with and growing in the Lord. You stay involved in ministry. You surround yourself with godly friends. You avoid things that are going to cause like pornography and relationship polluters and killers. And then the last step in that is something called intimacy with integrity. I'm not sure where you're at on your outline. So you got casual friendship, then you have deeper friendship. I've mentioned a variety of things. Then intimacy with integrity. Based on the character I've observed in our friendship, would I consider marrying this person? Am I prepared to move this relationship beyond friendship to pursue marriage? And you guys, when that time comes and you begin to develop that relationship, you are going to be spending some time with them. You are going to be doing things with them, but always with the same pattern of righteousness that you had before. I think I've included some things there. You're looking for green lights. Is that stuff on there? God's word. Is this an appropriate time, appropriate place, appropriate person? Green light two, you're ready for marriage. I could actually do this. Green light three, approval and support of authority figures, their parents, your parents, the members of the church. And God's peace, which is not a superficial, made-up peace, but a true peace which says, I know this is in accord with godly principles. And so, like, I can be at peace with this. You define the relationship's purpose. We are pursuing marriage. This is what we're doing. You get the proper permission. You take your time. Do I have a bunch of things down there? Yeah, look at all those. You stay public. You don't possess. You understand what it would mean, because even there you could break up. You stay involved in ministry. You stay pure. You test and build a relationship in real life settings. You bring the romance home. You reserve all your passion for marriage. I'm going to close with two challenges. One, a positive one. How many know Jen, now English? Okay. Jen is not perfect. She's never been perfect. All right, and she knows that and you know that. Yeah, when I came to this church 4.5 years ago, Jen was singing and involved. She was a church secretary of some level. She was doing all this ministry. How many eligible single young men were in our congregation when I came here 4 years ago? Yeah, like zero. I'm trying to remember if there were any guys that would really be insulted by my saying that. You guys don't count. I don't think so. There weren't any. Jen was faithful. And I know she paid a price for that. She had other friends, and she tried some other relationships. I think she did that in a generally godly way. But you know what it took? It took God to send someone from across the mountains, to send their parents to come here as kind of the advanced scout team. Hey, this is a good-looking girl. They were looking out for their son. That's good parents ought to do. They said, good-looking godly girl. You ought to come over. So he came over, and he started coming. I remember watching that. He came once, and he came again. And it was pretty soon, I think. And then he started coming pretty regularly. I'm going, oh, okay. No, he's not coming for the preaching. Okay? Sorry. I knew that. Oh, yeah, okay. He's like, yes, he was coming for, maybe that helped. See, Jen's benefit that she was in a place where the preaching was so great. No. But you guys, she stayed faithful. You know what? God brought her someone who didn't even live here. I had a 6-month checkup with them 3 or 4 months ago. Sat in my office, and I asked them question after question about how they were doing. I rarely have had such a good report. Rarely. I know they're not perfect. I know they have, again, I know that. The report was beautiful. You guys, I would hold that out to you. It's not the only pattern. But she was faithful. God brought the one she needed. Didn't mean she wasn't thinking about it, preparing for it. She wasn't saying it's not important. Believe me, she wasn't saying that. Okay? She didn't ignore it. But she waited. So I would offer that as positive model that you have seen, that you don't have to go running around pursuing all these things, and you certainly don't have to try to do it in high school. And then I guess not really negative, but the other thing I would ask, considering your physical relationship, I'm gonna lay something out there for you. Scripture does not give us any leeway for physical involvement with someone who is not our wife. It doesn't. You know, some people, I don't see any scriptural principles that say how physical I should get with someone who's not my wife. Sure, because there aren't any. It says in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 1, that you are to Paul, to Timothy, you are to treat, do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if you were a father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. That's the only standard, direct standard we have of how a young man should treat a young woman apart from marriage. That's a pretty high standard. Right? And so I want to lay out for you. Now, guys, there's conscience issues in there of how that's viewed before marriage. But I want to lay, just in the purity area, I want to lay something out for you. Why is it necessary to engage and initiate in physical contact of really any sort until you get married? Well, what about holding him? Can I at least do that? Can I kiss him? Can I at least do that? I'm going to lay that out there for you. And I'm going to ask you to think about that very carefully. We kind of have this, well, if I do this, it's okay. If I do this, it's okay. Because I know there were three couples in my own youth group who chose, not because I told them to do this, but because simply I laid this out there as something to think about. I'm not setting this as the only standard for any kind of physical purity. I'm simply saying I would ask you to think about it. Is it necessary to do anything physical before marriage? Is it necessary? That's what I'm asking. And then I'm saying, consider that. And they made a commitment, these couples, to say, you know what? Our first kiss is going to be at the altar. Now, please, I'm not setting that out as the only kind of standard that exists. They were not more super spiritual and better than every other couple because they did that. I'm only saying, would you consider it? Would you consider it? That might be the direction you move your standard. Consider that. Because, you guys, it kept them from a lot of heartache and a lot of grief that they didn't need to go through. And me, again, they're sinners. So, guys, I just want to lay some of those things out there for you. I've said a lot. Now I want you to go talk about it with your parents for a little bit. And you got about 15 minutes is all I can give you tonight. But what I want you to do is just begin the discussion. Maybe just some of your initial reactions or responses. You have some questions there. I want you to answer the bottom question, the very last question. Make sure you get to that one. And we'll come back together and discuss that for a bit. I'm going to give you 20 minutes. All right, that'll put us at 8:35. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. So go with your family. Talk about a few of those things I said. We'll come back together and pray to finish out our class. Callie, I have a notebook for you. Where's Callie? Sorry. Oh, did you get one? Okay.